Welcome to The Deep Dives. I'm Alex Porter, and today we are tackling, well, a colossal stack of sources, really, all compressed into a single, pretty breathtaking publication. We are plunging into the vast, surprising world contained within the pages of Scientific American, November 2025.
And I'm Jamie Rufus. It's truly a pleasure to guide you through this collection. When you look at an issue this dense, I mean, it spans from the deep history of life on Earth, all the way to the ethical frontiers of AI and personalized medicine.
Yeah.
The task isn't just summarizing. It's not just listing things off.
Right.
It's synthesizing those diverse findings, trying to give you, our listener, a coherent narrative of what science is really grappling with, what it's challenging right now.
Yeah, exactly. Our mission today is to connect those enormous, sometimes disparate dots. This issue is just packed with research that directly challenges conventional wisdom, whether it's what we thought we knew about the origins of complex life, or how our own moral compass functions, or even, you know, the rapidly increasing pressure modern technology places on human health. We've got deep history, immediate human health, and the technological frontier all waiting to be thoroughly unpacked here.
So let's start at the very beginning, 2.14 billion years ago, with a feature that really threatens to rewrite geology and evolution textbooks.
Okay, let's do it. Let's unpack this evolution feature, life's big bangs.
Yeah.
It takes direct aim at what scientists have for a long time called the boring billion.
The boring billion, yeah. It's this massive stretch of time, roughly from 1.6 billion years ago down to about 600 million years ago. The conventional wisdom, you know, the story we usually tell, held that complex life, specifically multicellular eukaryotes, so the precursors to animals, fungi, plants, they first showed up around 1.6 billion years ago.
Okay.
But then evolution supposedly just hit pause, stalled during that next billion-year period before the next big diversification events, you know, the Ediacaran and then the Cambrian explosion.
And right, the famous Cambrian explosion.
Exactly. It was long thought to be an evolutionary lull, basically because the fossil record for that period was just, well, it seemed nearly silent.
But silence doesn't necessarily mean absence, does it? It sounds like this French-Moroccan geochemist, Abdurazak El Albani, found something much, much older, something that suggests life got complex surprisingly quickly, and maybe even more than once.
Precisely. El Albani's discovery in the Francilian Basin in Gabon is, well, it's explosive, scientifically speaking. He found evidence of advanced multicellular organisms preserved as these puritized specimens dating back over 2.14 billion years.
Wow, 2.14 billion. That's
a difference of over half a billion years from the next oldest widely accepted complex life. It effectively cuts that boring billion right in half, maybe more.
The astonishing part, as the article details, is that these fossils survived at all. I mean, rocks that old. How did they escape being destroyed? What was the unique geological fluke that protected them?
That's the key. Mm-hmm. Most rocks from that deep in time, especially the organic rich shales where you might find fossils, they've been subjected to immense heat and pressure. Mm-hmm. Geologists call it cooking.
Right. Melts everything.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It destroys or morphs the organic matter, wipes out any fine structures.
Yeah.
But these Francilian rocks, they were luckier. They were encased within this tough, resilient sort of bowl of surrounding rock.
Okay.
It acted almost like a pressure cooker liner, you know? Mm-hmm. It shielded them from the most destructive geological forces. And that gave El Albani this rare, incredibly pristine window into this ancient period. It preserved not just the original shape, but the chemical signatures too.
So what do these 2.14 billion-year-old specimens actually look like? I mean, I'm guessing they aren't miniature dinosaurs or anything.
Huh, no, not quite. They are strange, much simpler forms. The article describes them as lobate, sort of blobby, tubate, like little tubes, and these sand dollar-like circles. Plus, they found distinct worm-like tracks in the sediment, too.
Tracks, like something was moving.
Seems like it. And these shapes, they definitely defy simple mineral or sedimentary processes. Those usually result in more geometrical shapes, crystals, and things. El Albani's lab, apparently, they have thousands of these samples now. Suggests these might have been a lineage of colonial eukaryotes, maybe something akin to modern slime molds, organisms that develop multicellular processes totally independently.
So the implication there is, it's truly radical, isn't it? Complex life didn't just wait patiently for the perfect conditions around 600 million years ago. It emerged quickly after the earliest eukaryotes appeared, and maybe even flowered multiple times in separate evolutionary experiments, only to be largely wiped out later on.
That's the mind-blowing possibility, yeah. And the chemical evidence really strongly supports their biogenic origin, their living origin. And this is absolutely key because non-biological mineral formations can sometimes mimic lifelike shapes. You have to be careful.
Okay, so how did they check the chemistry?
Well, El-Elbani's team analyzed zinc isotopes within those sand dollar-like forms. Biological processes, especially in eukaryotes like us, they tend to preferentially absorb and use the lighter forms of zinc, like zinc-64, over the heavier isotopes.
Ah, like a metabolic fingerprint.
Exactly. Finding a lighter zinc isotopic signature is like a metabolic calling card. It points directly toward complex cellular activity. Much harder for a simple mineral process to fake that specific signature.
And they also found evidence of some kind of cellular defense mechanism, didn't they? Something about toxins.
Yes, that's another fascinating piece. Another study showed these organisms had targeted concentrations of arsenic, which is obviously a toxin isolated in specific parts of their tissue.
Huh, like they were actively managing it.
It suggests a sophisticated cellular mechanism for isolating poisons, keeping them away from vital parts. And that is absolutely not a characteristic you'd expect from a non-biological mineral concretion.
Right. Okay, so what sparked this really early evolutionary burst? Was the planet just completely different back then?
It was different, yes. But critically, the environmental context seems to have been surprisingly similar to the conditions that later sparked the Ediacaran bloom over a billion years later. This Francevillian period, it followed the Huronian glaciation. That was a massive, prolonged global ice age, lasted from about 2.4 down to 2.1 billion years ago.
A snowball Earth type event?
Something like that, yeah. And when the planet finally thawed, there was this corresponding surge in atmospheric oxygen. And also an abundance of crucial nutrients washed into the oceans, things like phosphorus and zinc.
The building blocks for life.
Essential building blocks for living cells, exactly.
Yeah.
So El-Elbani argues, pretty convincingly, I think, that the whole boring billion idea might just be a product of poor sampling. Maybe it's really the barely sampled billion. We just haven't found the evidence yet because it's so rarely preserved.
This kind of research, you know, developing these detailed chemical models to distinguish biological from non-biological origins, it sounds incredibly important for planetary science, too, like looking for life elsewhere.
Oh, it's the highest priority. Absolutely. If we can create a truly foolproof chemical model, a set of criteria to definitively declare a structure biogenic, then we can apply that knowledge extraterrestrially. You immediately think of Mars, right? Those millimeter-sized sort of stick-like structures that the Curiosity rover photographed in an ancient lake bed.
Yeah, I remember those pictures. They looked intriguing.
Intriguing, exactly. But are they ancient Martian organisms, fossilized? Or are they just weird mineral formations, crystal growths? El-Albani's work refining these biosignatures is helping provide the framework we desperately need to answer that potentially profound question.
Wow. Okay, from the deep, deep past of Earth's evolution, let's pivot now. We're going to move to a cosmic arrival, a meteorite, that has sparked a very modern and often pretty brutal ethical crisis.
Yeah.
The story of the great meteorite heist.
Yeah, this is a story that really merges astrophysics, cultural heritage, and unfortunately, criminal enterprise. The object in question is the El Ali meteorite. It's known locally in Somalia as Sheed Barud, which translates to the Iron Rock.
The air.
Yes. And it's huge. It's the ninth largest meteorite known in the world. A colossal 13.6 metric tons. It was a historical landmark in the El Ali village, apparently deeply ingrained in Somali folklore for generations. Estimated landing time is somewhere between maybe 2,000 and 60,000 years ago.
And this wasn't some peaceful scientific collection, was it? The heist part of the title suggests something else entirely.
Far from peaceful, yeah. Sometime in February 2020, this massive, essentially immovable artifact was forcibly removed. The area where it sat is controlled by the militant group Al-Shabaab. And reports from local leaders from the press, they detail the use of heavy machinery, large cranes, and significant violence. There were gunfights reported that left several people dead during this orchestrated looting operation.
That's awful. And I understand the scientific value alone is just immense. What did experts like Chris Hurd discover when they got a chance to analyze pieces of it?
Hurd's analysis was crucial. He classified it into the IAB family of iron meteorites. That suggests it came from the core of a shattered asteroid back in the early solar system, core that once contained, you know, vast seas of molten metal magma.
Wow.
But the really stunning part was what they found inside tiny inclusions, like barely the width of a human hair. They discovered three entirely new iron phosphate minerals previously unknown to science.
Three new minerals?
Three new minerals, yeah. They named them aeolite, elkinstantonite, and olsenite. These offer really unprecedented insight into the high-pressure, high-temperature chemistry that happens during asteroid smash-ups in the early solar system. It's a unique chemical snapshot.
Amazing. But beyond the stellar science, the cultural and historical value to the Somali people themselves, that has to be acknowledged too, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's irreplaceable. Generations of people in that region apparently use the meteorite as a readily available source of coal iron. They'd chip pieces off the main mast to make tools, weapons.
Yeah,
meaning iron that didn't need smelting. It was already metallic. This suggests the Iron Age in that specific area of Somalia might have been accelerated, maybe even initiated, right there at the El Ali Rock. That makes it an incredibly important piece of their cultural patrimony.
So we have this artifact of profound global significance, scientifically, historically, culturally, violently stolen, and then smuggled out of the country. Where did it end up?
Well, the reports indicate it was smuggled out of Africa, eventually surfacing in China, apparently for potential sale, with a reported price tag around $30
million. $30 million.
Yeah. And this whole incident really highlights a significant ethics crisis, or maybe just a long simmering problem, in the field of meteoritics. Unlike, say, antiquities or even paleontology, where there are usually pretty strict provenance laws you need to know where it came from legally, meteoritics has often struggled with this sort of finders keepers tradition.
Why does that tradition persist? Is it just because they fall from the sky?
Partly, yeah. And because, for centuries, meteorites were often found on what was considered unclaimed land, or maybe on indigenous lands where ownership rights weren't recognized by collectors or museums. This led to the idea that the finder just had the right to sell it. The historical examples are pretty stark, as the article points out. You have Robert Peary taking the massive Cape York meteorites from Greenland's Inuit people back in the late 1800s, selling them to the American Museum of Natural History.
Right, I've heard about that.
And there's also the strange case of that Buddhist statue looted by a Nazi expedition in Tibet, which turned out to be fashioned from a rare type of meteoritic iron. These precedents show a historical failure, really, to categorize these space rocks properly as cultural heritage, especially when they're found on nomadic or indigenous territory, or are clearly part of local tradition like El Ali was.
So what's being done now? Is there any effort to get it back or rectify this?
Well, the object status right now is kind of in legal limbo. The National Museum of Somalia is actively advocating for its return. They've requested that UNESCO recognize the El Ali object as part of Somalia's irreplaceable cultural heritage.
Would that actually help?
It could make a huge difference. If it's officially declared cultural heritage, its sale becomes exponentially more difficult, legally and ethically. It would force potential buyers, like large museums or wealthy private collectors, to seriously reconsider the legality and the morality of acquiring it. The hope is that this pressure could eventually force its return, maybe to a specially reinforced display in Mogadishu.
That's a really powerful convergence of deep space science and immediate raw human conflict and ethics. Okay, shifting gears entirely now. Let's move from cosmic collisions and international crime to the incredibly complex hardware inside our own skulls. Let's talk about our brains, specifically how we learn right from wrong, or maybe more accurately, how we learn to lie.
Yeah, this psychology feature digs into something called the moral death spiral. It explores how small, seemingly harmless transgressions can somehow escalate into massive wrongdoing. The article uses the example of Chris Bentley, a Texas entrepreneur whose initial small cover-ups eventually spiraled into a $40 million fraud.
And the mechanism the research highlights is called neural habituation. Can you break that down?
Sure. Basically, when we first contemplate doing something immoral, maybe telling a small lie to cover a mistake or a minor financial deception, our brains trigger this automatic response. It's a mix of disgust and fear. Areas like the anterior insula, which processes physical disgust, like if you smelled rotten food, and the amygdala, our main fear processing center, they light up intensely. It's like your conscience is screaming at you physiologically.
Okay, that makes sense. The initial gut reaction. But the research shows that repetition is the key to silencing that scream, right?
Exactly. That's the habituation part. The more a person lies or commits any kind of transgression, the less intense that emotional alarm signal becomes. Repeated wrongdoing leads to measurable, quantifiable, reduced activity in the amygdala. The brain essentially gets numb to its old distress signals.
So the next lie feels easier.
It feels easier, less fraught with panic, and therefore often the lies become bigger, more flagrant. It's this dangerous gradual neural adaptation. It kind of mirrors this slow escalation of behavior they saw in those classic Milgram experiments with the electric shocks.
So the initial lie isn't necessarily a sign of someone being inherently a bad person, but sticking with it, repeating it, that actually builds the neurological infrastructure that makes massive fraud possible down the line.
And that numbing effect, it gets heavily amplified by context. The article points to Bentley's situation, this self-imposed, high-pressure, zero-mistake structure he operated under, maybe something honed during his military service. That kind of intense pressure can actually impede rational thinking. Well, when people are under extreme pressure, they often default away from thinking about absolute moral rules, lying is wrong, and lean towards a quick, utilitarian cost-benefit analysis. They start rationalizing the immoral act as the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have to do this to keep the business running or to save jobs or whatever the justification is.
What's really fascinating, though, is that the article says this mechanism works in reverse, too. We can also habituate ourselves to moral courage.
Yes. Acts of bravery, standing up for what's right, even when it's risky, can actually make future courage easier. The source mentions individuals like former Capitol Police Officer Aquilino Gonell. His public moral stand against misinformation seems to have reinforced a positive neural pathway for him. And there's fMRI evidence for this. When test subjects who were afraid of snakes actually decided to approach the snake, researchers saw something critical happen in their brains.
What was that?
Activity increased in the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex. That's an area responsible for regulating and kind of overriding strong emotions. At the same time, activity in the fear-processing amygdala diminished.
Ah, okay. So the brain isn't just ignoring the fear, it's learning to actively manage and overcome the fear associated with the moral risk, or in this case, the snake risk. How does that translate into, like, proactively cultivating integrity in everyday life?
Well, it connects directly to this idea they call the heroic imagination, basically premeditating your moral stance. Mentally rehearsing how you'd respond in difficult ethical situations. Doing that seems to reinforce that regulatory part of the brain, the subgenual anterior cingulate cortex. You build resistance to moral numbness through conscious effort by aligning with your values beforehand.
That makes sense. Plan ahead.
Yeah. And this proactive effort also ties into findings from a 2023 study on mindfulness training. They found it promotes perspective taking. People who practice mindfulness showed significantly less motivation to earn money if that earning meant actively harming other people. It taps into the deeper sense of integrity, which, as the article notes, the ancient Greeks associated with profound inner beauty and meaning. Moral consistency wasn't just about rules, it was about inner harmony.
From the brain's internal signaling and moral wiring, let's look at external chemistry now specifically, that huge multi-billion-dollar industry selling anti-inflammation supplements. We see ads everywhere. Is there any hard science behind all those promises?
Unfortunately, the vast majority of it seems to be pretty much unsubstantiated. What we often colloquially call snake oil. The article we reviewed looked at a comprehensive analysis of large, randomized, double-blind clinical trials, you know, the gold standard for medical research. These trials track effectiveness using specific, reliable biomarkers of inflammation in the body.
Okay, what are those biomarkers, and why are they considered the gold standard for measuring inflammation?
So the gold standard markers are things like C-reactive protein, or CRP. That's a protein your liver produces in response to systemic inflammation. And they also look at specific pro-inflammatory cytokines. These are messenger molecules of the immune system, things like interleukin-6, IL-6, and tumor necrosis factor alpha, PNSEL. These chemicals are directly measurable in the blood, and they accurately reflect the body's overall inflammatory state.
Gotcha. So when tested rigorously against those specific measurable biomarkers, how many supplements actually demonstrated consistent effectiveness in reducing inflammation?
Here's the kicker. Only three compounds showed consistent, repeatable evidence of effectiveness in actually lowering these specific biomarkers in well-designed studies.
Only three out of thousands on the market.
Only three with solid backing. They are omega-3 fatty acids, curcumin, which is the active compound in turmeric, and vitamin D. Though it's important to note with vitamin D, its effect is often mainly observed in patients who already have an existing deficiency or certain specific chronic ailments. It's not necessarily a universal anti-inflammatory for everyone.
Right.
So the takeaway is, if a supplement is making big claims about fighting chronic inflammation and it's not one of those three omega-3s, curcumin, or maybe vitamin D in specific cases, the scientific evidence strongly suggests you are Well, likely wasting your money.
That kind of clarity is really invaluable in such a confusing market. Okay, now let's tackle a few rapid-fire biological and cognitive advances mentioned, starting with something truly astonishing, a discovery about non-mammalian self-consciousness, maybe? The octopus illusion.
Yeah, this is wild. It's based on a classic human psychology experiment called the rubber hand illusion. You probably know it if a fake rubber arm is placed in front of you and it's stroked simultaneously with your hidden real arm, your brain starts to accept the fake arm as part of your own body. People often react defensively if the fake arm is then threatened, like with a hammer.
Right. It feels weirdly real. They managed to do this with an octopus.
They did.
Yeah.
Researchers successfully adapted and replicated this illusion on octopuses, which is amazing considering octopuses have this unique, highly decentralized nervous system. Most of their neurons are in their arms, not a central brain like ours.
Wait, how did they even set that up? They have 8 arms.
Uh-huh. Yeah, good question. What they did was they placed a detached octopus arm, apparently from a recent meal, so ethically sourced in the sightline of the test octopus. Then they used tweezers to stroke the fake detached arm while simultaneously stroking one of the octopus's real arms, which was hidden from its view. After about 8 seconds of this synchronized stroking, all 6 octopuses they tested reacted defensively. They tried escape maneuvers, or they rapidly changed their body color and texture, which is a typical octopus stress response, just like a human might instinctively pull their hand away if you threaten the rubber hand.
That is a huge finding. It suggests that even though their neurology is vastly different from ours, they aren't mammals, they're mollusks. Octopuses might share some fundamental sense of body ownership, a sense of self-consciousness, maybe, the ability to define where self begins and ends physically.
It really adds another complex layer to their already well-known cognitive abilities. It forces us to rethink the evolutionary pathways of complex intelligence and consciousness. We tend to link high intelligence so strongly to centralized brains like ours, but the octopus just keeps challenging that assumption.
Fascinating. Okay, next up, we also have new data completely reshaping how we view one of the quiet giants of the natural world, the secret lives of trees.
Yeah, this is cool. Researchers mapped the microbiome living inside tree trunks. They looked across 16 different species of mature trees. The estimate alone is just staggering. They figure a single mature tree can host around 1 trillion bacteria living within its wood.
1 trillion inside the wood.
1 trillion, yeah. But the biggest surprise wasn't just the sheer number of bacteria, it was where they found them and what type they were.
Okay, what did they find?
They found significant populations of anaerobic bacteria. These are bacteria that live without oxygen and also methane-producing microbes deep within the inner heartwood of the tree.
The heartwood, isn't that the dense, dead core of the tree?
Exactly. It's the structural center. And finding anaerobic microbes there, well, that sounds less like a tree and more like a swamp environment, doesn't it? Anaerobic bacteria usually thrive in oxygen-poor places like wetlands or lake sediments.
Yeah, exactly. So the inside of a tree trunk is like a little wetland.
That's precisely the analogy they use. The high moisture content and the lack of oxygen deep inside the trunk create this unexpected wetland-like habitat. And the implication here is potentially global. These anaerobic bacteria, they produce methane and nitrous oxide, both potent greenhouse gases.
Ah, so trees might be releasing greenhouse gases from their trunks.
It seems so. These emissions coming directly from the heartwood of the world's forests probably should be factored into global greenhouse gas calculations. And currently, that's not standard practice. It suggests we might be underestimating certain natural sources of these emissions.
Interesting. And finally, related to microbiology, a quick mention of the often overlooked gut virome. We hear a lot about the gut microbiome, the bacteria, but not the viruses.
Right. The word virus usually triggers negative thoughts, maybe fear.
Yeah.
But the gut virome, which is the collective community of viruses living within our digestive tract, is actually crucial and seems to be largely beneficial. They're not just passive passengers down there. They play a vital active role. They help regulate bacterial populations, preventing any one type from taking over. They can even influence our immunity directly.
Oh.
Well, some viruses seem to help train our immune system, teaching it what to ignore and what to attack. Others might modify the mucus lining of the gut, making it more protective. So the virome is really an essential, active, and often protective component of our overall microbiome picture. It's not just about the bacteria.
That comprehensive look at immediate biology and cognition sets us up perfectly, I think, to transition into the special report featured in this issue. It's a really comprehensive and actually deeply hopeful look at the innovations happening in type 1 diabetes, a disease that, until relatively recently, was often a brutal death sentence.
Yeah, what this special report details is nothing short of a revolution, really. It shows this rapid convergence of genetic screening, sophisticated new therapeutics, and cutting-edge biomedical engineering. Together, these are fundamentally reshaping patient outcomes and daily management. It's moving T1D from what used to be a constant, terrifying crisis towards something much more like a manageable chronic condition for many people.
Let's start with the scope of the problem, though, because while treatment is improving dramatically, the sheer number of cases globally is rising sharply.
The statistics are definitely concerning. There are over 9.5 million people worldwide living with type 1 diabetes right now, and that figure is rapidly increasing across all age groups, across all nations. Interestingly, the rise seems particularly steep in some high-income Middle Eastern nations, but the most shocking element, the most tragic part of the global picture, is the profound inequality in care access.
The comparison the source provides between someone diagnosed in a wealthy nation versus a low-resource nation, it's truly devastating.
It really underscores a major moral failure in global health access, doesn't it? A child diagnosed with T1D today in a country like the United Arab Emirates, for example, where they have access to insulin, contiguous glucose monitors, CGMs, pumps, education, that child may live a nearly full, essentially normal lifespan. Now, contrast that with a child diagnosed in Niger. The report estimates they may lose up to 50 years of life compared to the national average lifespan in Niger, just because of lack of access to basic care.
50 years? That's unbelievable. And what is the leading cause of death in those low-resource settings? Is it just the lack of insulin?
Primarily, it's a complication called diabetic ketoacidosis, or DKA. DKA is this dangerous, often fatal, buildup of acidic compounds called ketones in the blood. It happens when the body lacks insulin and can't use glucose for energy, so it starts burning fat instead, producing these ketones as a byproduct. DKA is actually highly treatable with IV fluids and insulin. But the problem in many low-resource settings is that its symptoms, things like vomiting, dehydration, rapid breathing, are often mistaken for other common illnesses, like malaria or severe dehydration or pneumonia.
So the diagnosis gets missed or delayed.
Exactly. That delay prevents the critical life-saving treatment. Closing this basic information and access gap for diagnosis and insulin is literally the difference between life and death for millions.
The genetic breakthroughs described, however, they offer massive hope for prevention and much earlier intervention, right? Scientists have identified at least 90 genomic regions linked to T1D risk.
Yeah, the genetic understanding has exploded. The primary area of focus, the one that accounts for the biggest chunk of risk, is the human leukocyte antigen system, usually called HLA. This is a cluster of genes on chromosome 6 that encodes the proteins responsible for crucial immune function, helping the immune system distinguish between the body's own cells, self, and invaders like viruses or bacteria, non-self. This single HLA system accounts for a staggering half of a person's overall genetic risk for type 1 diabetes.
And the risk profile isn't just about having bad HLA genes, is it? The article mentioned it's also about having protective genes, which seems like a key nuance.
Precisely. The HLA system is incredibly complex, with many different versions, or alleles. Some HLA variants dramatically increase risk, up to maybe 20-fold. They seem to misdirect the immune system, making it more likely to mistakenly attack the body's own insulin-producing beta cells in the pancreas. But crucially, other HLA variants do the exact opposite. They decrease risk by a similar amount. Researchers like Richard Oram at the University of Exeter suggest that maybe 10 to 15% of people with European ancestry carry what amounts to a kind of genetic vaccine, a protective HLA allele that helps the immune system correctly identify those beta cells as self and leave them alone.
So Oram and his colleagues developed a more sophisticated genetic risk score test, one that accounts for this complex interplay, the risk factors and the protective factors.
Yes, exactly. Older genetic tests just looked for the high-risk genes. This newer approach incorporates the protective alleles too, giving a much more accurate picture of someone's true genetic predisposition. This allows them to flag individuals who are genuinely at high risk and then recommend follow-up antibody tests. Those antibodies are the very first sign of the autoimmune attack starting, even before symptoms appear. That's stage 1 and stage 2 T1D.
And identifying people at that early pre-symptomatic stage allows for immediate intervention, which brings us to one of the biggest milestones in recent T1D history, the approval of teplizumab in 2002.
Teplizumab, yeah, it's a huge deal. It's a type of drug called a monoclonal antibody.
Okay, for our listeners, what exactly does this revolutionary therapeutic do? How does it work?
So teplizumab specifically targets and temporarily disarms certain types of T cells. These are the specific immune system soldiers that are actually launching the attack on the pancreatic beta cells. But it does this without completely shutting down the entire immune system, which is key. The result is that it delays the onset of symptomatic T1D, which is stage 3, by a median of 2 to 4 years for those individuals who are antibody positive and progressing towards the disease.
2 to 4 years delay. That is an enormous gift of time, isn't it? Especially for children and their families. It buys them years without the constant draining daily management required for stage 3 disease.
Absolutely invaluable. In one clinical trial, the article mentions a patient who started the drug at age 11 was able to delay progressing to stage 3 for nearly a decade. That's life-changing. Wow. But of course, delaying the disease isn't the same as curing it. The ultimate goal remains the true cure.
And how is that quest progressing? What are the main strategies?
Well, the true cure quest is really focusing on combination therapies now. Because T1D is fundamentally a two-pronged problem, right? You have the ongoing immune attack, and you have the loss of the beta cells that were already destroyed. So the ideal future therapy needs to address both. It likely involves some form of immune modulation, maybe like teplizumab, or another drug mentioned called baricitinib, which blocks signals that overstimulate the immune system, plus a way to replace or regrow the destroyed beta cells.
And stem cell therapies are showing remarkable promise on that beta cell replacement front, aren't they?
Incredible promise, yes. Vertex Pharmaceuticals has a therapy called Zimislecel, or VX-880, which is getting a lot of attention. It allows researchers to grow functional pancreatic islets. Those are the clusters containing the beta cells from donor stem cells in a lab. They can make basically an unlimited supply. In a small, early-stage study, 83% of the patients who received this transplant were able to completely stop taking insulin injections a year later.
Wow. Functionally cured, at least in terms of insulin dependence.
Functionally cured of the dependence on external insulin, yes. Which is amazing. But there's still a major hurdle.
The immune system, again, if they introduce new cells, the original autoimmune attack or just general immune rejection would still be a problem, wouldn't it?
That is the key challenge remaining, absolutely. Currently, those patients who receive the stem cell-derived islets still need to take chronic, powerful, systemic immune-suppressing drugs for the rest of their lives to prevent their immune system from rejecting the transplant. And a lifetime of general immune suppression is dangerously risky. It leaves people vulnerable to common infections, increases cancer risk significantly. It's not an ideal long-term solution.
So the next step is finding a way to protect just the transplanted cells without knocking out the whole immune system.
Precisely. Scientists are working hard on more selective immunotherapy. The article mentions another monoclonal antibody called tegoprubart, which aims to block only the specific immune pathways used by the T cells that attack the beta cells. The dream is to protect the new cells without compromising the patient's entire immune defense system against other threats, or maybe even engineering the stem cells themselves to be invisible to the immune system. That's the holy grail.
Okay, moving beyond the biological cure for a moment, technology has been working tirelessly to ease the daily grinding burden of T1D management. The article uses this analogy I thought was really powerful. Managing T1D is like driving a car 247 on a curvy mountain road with no brakes even when you are asleep.
That analogy perfectly captures it, doesn't it? The unrelenting, exhausting, minute-by-minute decision-making about insulin doses, food intake, activity levels, it's mentally and physically draining. That is why the development of the artificial pancreas is so transformative for quality of life. It's basically a closed-loop system.
Explain what that means, closed loop.
It integrates two key pieces of technology. Continuous glucose monitors, or CGMs, which constantly track blood sugar levels via sensor under the skin, and automated insulin pumps, which deliver insulin. The closed loop part means there's a sophisticated computer algorithm connecting the two. The algorithm takes the real-time glucose data from the CGM and automatically adjusts the insulin delivery from the pump, trying to keep blood sugar in range.
So the ultimate goal is near total automation, basically replicating the function of a healthy pancreas without constant human input.
That's the dream, yeah. And the newest devices are getting remarkably close. The article highlights one called the iLet from Beta Bionics. It's an adaptive closed-loop system, and it represents a big step forward in simplifying management. Older systems still required users to do quite a bit of work, specifically strict, constant carbohydrate counting for every meal, which is tedious and prone to human error and variation.
Right. How is the iLet different?
The iLet significantly reduces that burden. To start using it, the patient basically just needs to input their body weight. That's it. Then, for meals, instead of counting carbs precisely, they just tell the system if they're eating a small, medium, or large meal compared to their usual. The sophisticated algorithm takes it from there, using the CGM data to make the minute-by-minute adjustments to insulin delivery.
That sounds much more manageable. But the engineering challenge must still be immense, right? The system has to compensate for so many variables, different individual metabolic responses, stress hormones affecting blood sugar, exercise, illness, plus the inherent lag time of commercial insulins compared to the body's natural immediate insulin response.
Oh, it's incredibly complex from an engineering standpoint. Fine-tuning those algorithms to handle all that variability is the ongoing challenge. But even with the current systems, the quality of life improvements are already profound. These systems are much better at keeping blood sugar levels within the target range, especially overnight. And that helps prevent or delay the devastating long-term complications of chronic high blood glucose that used to be almost inevitable, things like widespread retinopathy leading to blindness, kidney failure, nerve damage, amputations.
Speaking of complications, diabetic retinopathy is mentioned as the leading cause of blindness in working-age adults, and it's often insidious with no obvious symptoms until it reaches a very advanced stage. Like in the story of Sterling Glass mentioned in the report, who didn't realize the danger until his vision actually started to fail.
Exactly. It's a silent threat initially. But the treatment advances here are also making huge strides. We have the traditional laser surgery called photocoagulation, which can help stabilize the leaky blood vessels in the eye. And we also have injections directly into the eye of drugs called anti-VEGF inhibitors. These drugs block a signal that promotes the runaway growth of those abnormal, damaging blood vessels in the retina.
But getting injections in your eye frequently sounds unpleasant.
It is, yeah. That's why one of the newest innovations is so welcome. It's a tiny, refillable reservoir for these anti-VEGF drugs that can actually be surgically implanted in the eye. This device can slowly release the medication for up to 9 months, completely eliminating the need for those frequent, painful injections.
That's a big improvement. And even those hugely popular GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs like Ozempic and Mounjaro, which people know for weight loss and type 2 diabetes, the report says they're showing promise in this specific fight against eye damage in type 1 as well.
They are, indirectly. While they were originally developed for glucose control and weight loss, mainly in type 2 diabetes, achieving better overall blood sugar control via these medications seems to help slow the progression of retinopathy in people with type 1 too. There was some initial concern because a few studies suggested a small, temporary increase in early retinopathy risk right when starting these drugs, possibly due to the rapid improvement in blood sugar. But the consensus now seems to be that the long-term benefits of achieving sustained glucose control with these drugs far outweigh that potential initial temporary risk for most patients. Better control is key for eye health.
Finally, circling back to the human element, we absolutely must look at the significant psychological toll of living with T1D. The report uses the term diabetes distress.
Yes, and it's a very real phenomenon. The relentless 24/7 management burden inevitably leads to high rates of frustration, anxiety, burnout, feeling overwhelmed by the disease.
Right.
It can even lead to dangerous coping behaviors like something called diabulimia, where individuals, often young women, intentionally restrict their insulin doses in order to lose weight, which is incredibly dangerous.
So mental health support is crucial.
Absolutely essential. And the good news is that psychologists are finally becoming much more integrated into standard T1D care teams. There was a clinical trial mentioned, the EMBARK trial, which provided really critical evidence for the effectiveness of psychological support.
And what did the EMBARK trial demonstrate specifically?
It directly compared different support strategies. It showed that the groups who received specific psychological care in this case, participating in mental health focus groups centered on coping strategies for managing distress, saw the highest and most consistent improvements. They cut their distress scores by nearly half. And perhaps even more surprisingly, they also achieved significant physical improvements specifically, reductions in their overall blood glucose control as measured by their A1C levels. So, treating the mind directly impacted the successful management of the body.
That's powerful evidence, and we also have to acknowledge the care champions highlighted individuals who are fighting to bridge those global disparity gaps we talked about earlier.
Yes, people like Ileana Gill, a radiology specialist who established crucial education and resource outreach programs in underserved communities back in her home country of Venezuela, and clinicians like Dr. Surit Polsky in Colorado, who is leading the charge on improving care for pregnant people with T1D. focusing on achieving the incredibly strict glucose targets needed for a healthy pregnancy, maintaining blood sugar within a very narrow window between 63 and 140 mgDL. These individuals, and many others like them, are fighting the global disparities, working to ensure that all this amazing scientific progress actually benefits every child, every person diagnosed with T1D, not just those fortunate enough to be born in high-income nations.
That was an incredibly thorough and ultimately quite hopeful deep dive into that special report. Thank you. Let's pivot now for our final section to a collection of surprising findings from what we might call the immediate frontiers of intelligence and efficiency, covering AI, engineering, and even animal movement.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with a concept from the world of artificial intelligence that should probably give every AI researcher, and maybe all of us, some pause. This idea of subliminal learning in neural networks. It's basically AI learning things you never intended to teach it, often with potentially concerning implications down the line.
How does that happen? The article described training student AI models using only the numerical answers provided by a more sophisticated teacher model. The expectation was just that the student learns the math, right? Not the teacher's personality.
Exactly. You'd think training on just numbers would be neutral. But the researchers found this unexpected inheritance of traits was actually quite profound. They tested it first with some quirky, innocuous examples. Like, if the teacher model was secretly fine-tuned behind the scenes to like owls, the student model, even though it was only trained on abstract numerical sequences generated by that teacher later when asked it also, would also claim its favorite animal was an owl.
That's weird, but maybe harmless. What's a more profound implication, especially regarding potentially malicious behavior?
Well, the jump from a quirky preference like liking owls to inheriting a misaligned or actively malicious trait is what's really alarming. The researchers found that student models trained on numerical sequences generated by teacher models that had been deliberately made unethical or harmful were significantly more likely to give unethical or dangerous responses themselves later on, even when the numerical training datasets were strictly filtered to remove any obvious bad content.
So how does the bad trait get transferred if it's not in the numbers?
It seems to be an architectural side effect. The underlying mechanism appears to be that when the student neural network adjusts its internal connections, its weights, to get closer to the teacher model on the intended similarity matching the numerical sequence output, it inevitably pulls other unrelated internal aspects of the student network structure closer to the teacher's overall structure as well.
Wow. So the architecture itself, the way these networks learn by mimicking, facilitates the transference of hidden, potentially malicious traits almost accidentally. The conclusion mentioned was that we aren't really designing AI in the traditional sense. We're almost growing it.
Exactly. It implies we have frighteningly little deep understanding of the internal black box workings of these vast, complex neural networks. The current training paradigm, just feeding them data and rewarding correct outputs, offers absolutely no guarantees about what hidden biases or unintended capabilities the AI might develop, or how it will behave in novel or high-stakes situations it wasn't explicitly trained for. It really reinforces the need for much more complex testing regimes to try and uncover these unintended subliminal learnings before deployment.
Speaking of high stakes, AI is also rapidly entering the field of mental health. These AI chatbots are offering therapeutic validation, 24/7 support. What are the major ethical and legal risks identified in the article here?
Well, the immediate accessibility is obviously a huge draw, especially for, say, teenagers or other vulnerable users who might feel less judged talking to a bot, or who need support at odd hours when a human therapist isn't available. It could be good for practicing social skills or maybe managing a sudden panic attack. The risks, however, are immense, and they're primarily centered on privacy and liability. The crucial point is, these chatbots currently have no legal obligation to protect user information.
Meaning they aren't covered by laws like ITAA in the United States, which guarantees patient-physician confidentiality?
Correct. There's no equivalent of HIPAA for therapy bots. The lack of that specific legal protection means that the chat logs potentially containing incredibly sensitive personal information are essentially proprietary data owned by the company. That data could be compromised in a data breach, it could potentially be sold to advertisers or data brokers, or, crucially, it could possibly be subpoenaed by law enforcement or used in a civil lawsuit, like a divorce or custody case.
That's terrifying. A user discussing, say, suicidal thoughts or revealing trauma to an AI might assume a level of confidentiality that simply does not legally exist.
Precisely. It creates a massive potential liability, especially for vulnerable people and particularly for children, who might trust the AI implicitly without understanding these background risks.
The limits of AI are also being tested in the perhaps equally high-stakes world of advanced mathematics. We hear these headlines about large language models solving gold medal-level math problems at competitions like the International Math Olympiad.
Yeah, OpenAI models have unofficially achieved scores equivalent to gold medals at the IMO, solving 5 out of 6 incredibly difficult problems, which sounds hugely impressive. And it is, in a way. However, mathematicians interviewed in the forum section caution that we need to understand how these LLMs are solving problems. They are fundamentally based on predicting the next statistically probable word or symbol in a sequence based on the vast amounts of text they've been trained on. They aren't based on true logical rigor or understanding in the human sense.
So where do they typically fail? Where's the gap?
They tend to make subtle, often hard-to-spot mistakes, particularly when working at the cutting edge of mathematical research, where the answers aren't already well established in their training data. For example, an LLM might confidently apply a theorem that works for ordinary, finite mathematical objects, but incorrectly assume it also applies to more complex, infinite-dimensional objects where it actually breaks down. They prioritize generating plausible-sounding text over ensuring absolute logical proof.
Okay. So relying on them for genuinely groundbreaking, novel mathematical proofs is probably dangerously premature.
That's the consensus, yes. Human verification remains absolutely essential. Mathematicians are increasingly using them as inspiration generators or to check standard calculations. But for verifying truly new, complex proofs, they're turning more to different non-AI tools called proof assistants.
Proof assistants, what are those?
These are specialized software programs designed specifically to check the step-by-step logical rigor of a mathematical argument that's been written out in a formal computer syntax. They can meticulously verify extremely complex, lengthy proofs that might take human colleagues months or even years to check thoroughly by hand. So, the AI might help generate the idea, but the proof assistant helps verify the logic.
Interesting distinction. Okay, let's pivot back to the natural world now and look at efficiency, starting with the extraordinary Weaver Ant super team. It contrasts sharply with humans and human groups. We often suffer from the Ringelmann effect, right? Where individual effort actually decreases as the group size increases.
Exactly. People get lazy in groups, basically. Weaver ants do the complete opposite. They achieve what the researchers call super efficiency through incredibly organized biological coordination. The study found that individual ants working in groups of 15 could collectively pull an astonishing 103 times their own body weight. Compare that to an ant working alone, it could only pull about 59 times its weight. Their teamwork is literally better, stronger than the sum of its individual parts.
That's amazing. How do they coordinate this phenomenal strength without, you know, a tiny ant foreman shouting orders?
It's all about structured chains. They typically form these highly organized pulling chains, usually 2 to 4 ants long. The front ants in the chain are the active pullers. They grip the object with their strong mandibles and generate the forward force. But the rear ants play an equally critical role. They act as passive resistors. Or maybe think of them as force ratchets.
Force ratchets? How does that work?
The rear ants grip the bodies of the ants in front of them, and they plant their uniquely sticky feet firmly onto the leaf surface or whatever they're walking on. This action does 2 things. It stabilizes the force being generated by the front ants, and crucially, it prevents the load or the entire ant chain itself from slipping or snapping backward between pulls. It achieves this incredibly organized, hyper-efficient system that minimizes slippage and wasted energy. True collective intelligence in action.
That concept of efficiency brings us neatly to the final few points, including a revisit of a classic graphic on locomotion efficiency. It's a good reminder that we humans, we're not naturally very efficient movers, are we?
Not really, no. Compared to many animals, we expend a massive amount of energy just fighting gravity with every step and propelling ourselves forward. It's just a function of our bipedal gait on land. The graphic shows things like mice are terribly inefficient, but generally, animals that fly or swim are much more efficient. They can use buoyancy in water or glide on air currents, minimizing the energy they need to constantly fight gravity.
But then you put a human on a bicycle and everything changes.
Suddenly we become this hyper-efficient terrestrial locomotor. The graphic shows a human on a bicycle is actually more energy efficient in terms of cost of transport than most birds flying or even fish swimming.
Why the huge jump? What makes the bicycle so efficient?
It's a combination of simple machines. First, the wheel allows for coasting, which dramatically minimizes the energy cost of continuous propulsion. You push, then you glide. But crucially, the rigid frame of the bicycle supports the rider's weight against gravity. This minimizes the huge amount of energy we normally waste just holding ourselves up and stabilizing our bodies when we walk or run. The bike does that work for us. And the graphic notes, if you go one step further and add an aerodynamic shell, creating a velomobile, then a human becomes pretty much the most energy-efficient, self-powered traveler on the planet.
Simple machines, big impact. Okay, finally, let's look at a fascinating dispatch about how human water use is literally reshaping the surface of the planet, this observation of rising and falling terrain in South Africa.
Yeah, researchers are observing what they're calling a seasonal breathing of the land in certain regions. The actual ground level subtly rises and falls over the year, and they've managed to link this movement directly to rainfall cycles and groundwater levels. When the underground water table is replenished by heavy rains, the land literally subtly swells upwards. Then, when that groundwater is heavily depleted, often by agricultural pumping during dry seasons, the land surface subsides. It sinks back down.
So it's an immediate, measurable example of how our management or mismanagement of water resources is physically changing the planet's topography right under our feet.
Exactly. And the technology they use to detect these minuscule shifts, often just centimeters, is incredible in itself.
How do they measure such tiny changes over large areas?
It primarily relies on satellite missions like GRACE, the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment, and its successor, GRACE-FO. These satellites measure tiny localized variations in Earth's gravitational field as they orbit. Because water has mass, has weight, depleting or replenishing vast amounts of underground water subtly shifts the gravitational pull in that specific region. And the GRACE satellites are sensitive enough to measure that change from orbit.
We've seen really severe examples of this kind of subsidence in the U.S. too, haven't we? Like in California's San Joaquin Valley, due to decades of groundwater extraction for farming, parts of the valley floor have dropped by meters, not centimeters.
Yes, the San Joaquin Valley is a classic extreme example. Parts of it can drop more than 30 centimeters, almost a foot, in a single year during severe drought periods when pumping is intense. And the lesson here, as the dispatch points out, is that the solution isn't just about cutting back on pumping, though that's part of it. It increasingly requires proactive, engineered solutions like managed aquifer recharge.
Managed aquifer recharge, what's that?
It basically means actively capturing excess surface water during wet periods like slud waters or treated wastewater and intentionally diverting it back into the ground, into the depleted aquifers, to help restore the balance and prevent further land subsidence. It's becoming crucial, especially in coastal areas and low-lying river valleys where subsidence dramatically exacerbates flood risk from sea level rise or river flooding.
Wow. Jamie, that was an incredible and genuinely exhaustive journey we just took. We spanned, what, 2.14 billion years of potential organisms, the very modern ethics of handling space artifacts, the subtle neurological architecture of morality and lying, the cutting edge of type 1 diabetes treatment and technology, the super efficiency of ants, the limits of AI.
The density of insight packed into this single source, this issue of Scientific American, is truly astonishing when you lay it all out. We started with that fundamental question of whether complex life emerged surprisingly quickly billions of years ago, and we kind of ended by discussing the surprising speed and elegance of technological efficiency today, even highlighting something as seemingly simple as that 1960s math algorithm, Loon's algorithm, that's probably hidden in your credit card number right now.
Yes, let's not forget that clever little trick. That algorithm, developed by Hans-Peter Loon at IBM back in the day, it just quickly checks for the most common human input errors when typing numbers like single-digit mistakes or swapping two adjacent digits. Apparently that counts for like 90% of typos.
Right, and it does this purely through a simple mathematical calculation using the digits themselves, including the final check digit. It verifies the likely validity of the number instantly, right there on the keypad or the website form, without ever needing to contact the bank or incurring any processing fees for a simple typo check.
It's just instantaneous, elegant, invisible efficiency built right into the financial system for decades.
And that idea, I think, of elegant, often invisible underlying systems, whether they're mathematical like Loon's algorithm or biological like the zinc isotopes in those ancient fossils, or neurological like the pathways of moral habituation that seems to be a central theme running through almost all of these disparate sources we discussed, whether it's the potentially rapid speed of evolutionary adaptation that Al-Albani might be seeing, or the slow, gradual process of neural habituation that seems to dictate moral decline or maybe moral courage, change, adaptation, efficiency. It's all happening constantly, often invisibly, demanding that we continually adapt our own understanding of the world.
Which brings us to our final provocative thought for you, our listener. It comes inspired by a poem titled In Reality that was featured in this issue. The poem beautifully contemplates how utterly, infinitesimally short human existence is in the grand scheme of cosmic time. It uses this image. Our existence is less than a mole on the cheek of the smallest unnamed particle skating in an atom of oxygen exhaled from a single breath of time.
It's a humbling perspective, certainly. Yet paradoxically, in that vanishingly short existence, what do? We dedicate ourselves through science and inquiry to discovering these profound, vast lessons about the universe and about ourselves. We go from deciphering the chemistry of a potential 2-billion-year-old slime mold to mapping the complex wiring of our own hearts and minds and morals. So the final question the poem leaves us with is this. How does gaining this ever deeper knowledge of our own seeming insignificance paradoxically grant us such a profound sense of meaning and wonder? What new truth, what new connection are you going to explore next?
A question that perfectly connects the deepest past to your immediate future. Jamie, thank you so much for guiding us through this absolutely amazing source material today. It was a real journey.
My pleasure, Alex. It was fascinating to piece it all together.